Thank you for having me here again. And I will tell you things which are not so new, because I tell them a lot of times, but which are such that many people don't believe them. So I hope either you believe them and join the party for relations and against properties, or we'll have good discussions, new arguments, etc. I'm looking very much forward to getting some feedback and to discussing the issues. So, just to warm up against properties. So the claim is there are no properties in the fundamental ontology. All there is are relations, and relations are sufficient, and relations can do all the work properties are supposed to do. And the argument for this claim that I would like to make is to consider this afternoon two prominent views of properties. On the one hand, the categorical view associated with Humeanism by David Lewis, and argue that from this view you can simply cut off from the Lewisian Humean metaphysics, you can simply cut off the properties and you don't lose anything. You even gain something. The position gains in strength. And then the other view, the modal view, the view of properties being dispositions or powers, there the argument will be that if these powers are conceived as intrinsic properties, they are just inappropriate for exercising the role for doing what they are supposed to do. And again, you are better off by switching to relations, and by switching to relations, you make out of this power position interesting, a powerful view for contemporary physics. So let's start with David Lewis. You know this, David Lewis, Humean Supervenience thesis, which is the doctrine that all there is to the world is a vast mosaic of local matters of particular fact, just one little thing and then another. We have a geometry, a system of external relations of spatiotemporal distance between points. Maybe points of space in itself, maybe points at bits of matter, either fields, maybe both. And at those points we have local qualities, perfectly natural, intrinsic properties, which need nothing bigger than a point at which to be instantiated. For short, we have an arrangement of qualities. And that is all. That's the famous Humean supervenience thesis, the Humean mosaic, points, point-sized objects, geometrical distance relations among these objects, local qualities at these points, and everything else, then including the laws, including the mind, including whatever there may be, supervenes on them. And these properties, they are categorical properties because there's no primitive modality. That's the point of Humeanism, to eschew any commitment to primitive, to something which is modal as a primitive matter of fact. So the properties categorical, not modal, and this means that whatever role they play, whatever causal or functional role they play, is not essential to them. So if you're at this fundamental level, if you have these local qualities at points, what is their causal role? Well, their causal role is to induce some sort of some change, some patterns of change in these spatial-temporal relations. If you have two masses here, they will attract each other. If you have charges, they will repel, etc., which means that the motion of the objects that instantiate these properties changes. But that causal role on Humeanism is not a local affair. It depends on the laws. And the laws in turn supervene on the whole mosaic. So you have local properties. These properties exercise a certain role. But what role they'll exercise is a contingent matter of fact. It's contingent upon what the rest of the world is like, which laws hold in the world, with these laws supervening on the mosaic. So you can have the same properties of the same type exercising different roles in different worlds. So to take one example, you could imagine that mass and charge swap. So in one world, say, the role that exercises the property that exercises the role of mass and world W may exercise the role of charge and W star, and the other way around, charge and W may exercise the role of mass and W star, so that these properties, when we come to these points, they are pure qualities in themselves, quiddities, and we cannot have any access to them, because all the access that we have is via the role the property exercises. But the role does not disclose its nature. This goes by the name of humility. Humility meaning that we don't know what the properties are in themselves. And this is quite mysterious now, because Humean metaphysics is supposed to be a position of metaphysics that is close to science and free of any spooky, mysterious metaphysical entities, but these local qualities, these properties, are just quite mysterious. They are pure qualities, and you cannot know what they are. You only know the role that they exercise. And that's a standard. Lewis himself bites the bullet of endorsing inquisitivism and humility, but it's quite a standard objection against Humean metaphysics that they have these commitments. But you don't need these properties. And so far as they are pure qualities, they cannot have any significance for the supervenient basis for laws. If you want something at the level of the supervenient basis, on which something else can supervene, you must have something that constitutes a discernible difference between these point-sized objects. Pure qualities being pure qualities, sitting around there, but not doing something insofar as they are pure qualities, does not help you. You cannot have something supervening on that. If you have something supervening, if this is going to do some work, it cannot just be that there are qualities sitting around, but that these qualities do a certain job, but what job they do comes out of the law, so we are back in a circle. So you need something which gives you some discernible difference. And the only discernible difference you have in here is given by the relations, by the external relation of spatial-temporal distance between points. They are the change in these relations. That's what makes all the difference in the world. So, throw away these local qualities. They are just an oddity in there. They get you into trouble, but they don't do, insofar as they are qualities, they don't do anything. Okay? So, what I want to do is just to stop here. So, we have relations between points. Don't have an arrangement of qualities, we have an arrangement of distance relations between points. Okay? So there's something fishy about this idea of having properties, categorical properties, as local qualities. You only get into trouble. You only get into the trouble of quiditism and humility. These local qualities don't do any job for the supervenience. So throw them away and see where we get. If you throw them away, we have to go back. The best idea we can do, we will go back to Leibniz. We have then Leibnizian, so if we have relations, put it that way. We need, stay for a minute with Lewis. Right? According to Lewis now, this quotation was from the papers from 1986, and then there's the book as well from 1986 on the plurality of worlds. And in that book, another place, Lewis says, and he's right in saying it, that we need some relations anyway. You need something that holds the things and the world together. And even if you think that there's only one substance, Jonathan Chaffer and his monism, even if you think, like Spinoza, there's only one whole, you need an internal differentiation. So you need some relations in that whole that give you some variations. Otherwise, you would not have any chance of obtaining empirical adequacy. It's variation in the world. We move, etc. So you need some relations to keep the world together anyway. Which relations can't you throw away? Well, the basic idea is spatial or spatial-temporal relations. You need those relations. You can't do without them. Lewis, in that book, he has the idea that perhaps charge relations could do it. But the problem with charge relations is that they won't distinguish the objects. There's just like charged and opposite charged, but it won't distinguish any objects. The spatial relations can do this. That's the idea of Leibniz, that you have distance relations between points. These points are not space-time points in that case. You only have point-sized objects, called metapoids, sparse objects. You have distance relations, and these distance relations are such that they discern these objects, and that's easy unless you have an entirely symmetrical configuration, but an entirely symmetrical configuration would again not be what the world is, would not be empirically adequate. And they give you variation, and by discerning these objects, they individuate them. So what you need is relations anyway. Lewis agrees with that as well. Nearly everybody agrees with that, apart from the people I mentioned, but they don't really have an argument how to deal. Never read or heard anything from them how to deal with spatial or spatial-temporal relations. Okay? These relations you need anyway. So perhaps they can do all the work. They can individuate the objects because they are able to distinguish the objects. These objects are distinguished by the distances in which they stand to each other. So they give you variation, they give you change if these distance changes, they give thereby you can introduce time. And then, as Lewis says, that is all. You don't need anything else. You switch now from the idea of having intrinsic properties to structural realism. What you get now is a structural individuation of the objects by the relations in which they stand, instead of an individuation through intrinsic properties. But this does not matter. There's nothing fishy about that, because structures in the sense of concrete relations, like distance relations, can do everything that properties, and by properties always mean intrinsic properties are supposed to do. So if you think of objects as bundles of properties, the bundle view, then you find the same view for structures and structural realism, what is known as radical ontic structural realism. Stephen French defends this position, James Ladyman as well. And they say that the objects are constituted by relations, and what they mean is that the objects are the nodes in a network of relations. So that's the bundle theory applied to relations. If you think, as I do, that there are substances, and that these substances instantiate properties, the traditional Aristotelian view, you can get it as well in structural realism. It's then what my PhD student Vincent Lamet I've called moderate structural realism. They are radical because they throw away the objects. We are moderate. We say there are objects, but all there is to these objects are the relations on which they stand. So objects and relations are on a par. They are mutually ontologically dependent. You cannot have relations without the relata that stands in the relations, and you cannot have the relata, the objects, without there being relations that relate them. If all there is to the relata are the relations in which they stand. Okay? So if you think that there are substances that instantiate properties, same thing can be done here. And note that you don't get to a Lockean view of the substances being bare substrata. Because if you took away all the relations, you would take away the objects as well. If all there is to the objects are the relations which they stand, there does not, if they are mutually ontologically dependent, there does not remain anything if you remove the relations. So you can defend the substance view of objects without being committed to a substratum view and without being committed to some sort of intrinsic essence in Aristotelian eidos of these objects. They're just the relations. That's all there is to them. And this view has a certain number of advantages now, at least the following three ones. You don't have the Leibnizian relationists. They don't have to buy into a dualism of matter and space-time. And that's an advantage to avoid a dualism of matter and space-time, because there are these, the Leibniz shift arguments against Newton. So Leibniz argues that the if there were an absolute space, you could place the whole configuration of matter somewhere else in that place, so you could remove the whole Corpus Christi College, say, to Los Angeles, and if you move the surrounding with it as well, you'll have the rain and the wind, etc. So you won't pursue, if you move the whole thing, the whole configuration, the whole universe in absolute space, 10 meters to the left or so, there won't be any change, but it would be another possible world. And in a Newtonian view, this would, the absolute space would expand to infinity, but you only have a finite configuration of matter, etc. So there are a number of good arguments against the dualism of matter and space-time. And furthermore, you have the problem, if you say matter is distinct from space-time, if you answer the question, what is matter? So you can restart the intrinsic properties issue, but this will get you into the trouble I mentioned before. You can be a Lockean and say matter is just a bare fact, bare substratum of matter, but that's not comfortable either. Okay, so you avoid all these troubles. The Leibnizian relationalist avoids all these troubles by saying that there are distance relations and that these distance relations individuate the objects. So you don't get in the Humean framework now. You are with the, if you throw away the properties, the natural properties that are pure qualities, you don't get any trouble with criticism and humility either. They are simply gone, these objections, which is a good news. And you don't get now. Why does Louis think that he has to be committed to natural properties? Well, he doesn't want the supervenient space is to be arbitrary. There's something natural about it which makes it that this is not the subjective matter, etc. So natural properties are very important for that. But if you throw them away, you don't get any arbitrariness either, because the distance relations, I said already, they are distinguished. They are the relations that unify the world. Or you could say someone else, if you think that it's wrong to put in distance relations here, okay, but the argument was if there's to be a world, there are some relations that unify the world, that make it that certain objects form a world, etc. Then these relations are distinguished, then these are natural relations, so to speak. There's no arbitrariness there. That's exactly, you may be wrong in thinking that it's Leibnizian spatial relations, maybe spatial-temporal relations. Some people think that in quantum gravity, space-time is no longer fundamental. I don't think that at all, but let that be another issue. Then they would have to come up with some other relations that fulfill the task of unifying the world and thereby counting as the relations that make up the supervenient spaces, and you won't get into any trouble of all this being arbitrary. What to do with properties then? They are predicates. So mass, charge, etc. So what would be candidates for natural properties in David Lewis? They, as I said before, they come into the system in any case when you want to name them and you want to say what are these properties, through the variables that figure in the laws of the best system. It's the system which is most simple and most informative, describing the patterns in the world and describing the change in distance relations among the matter points. And now, of course, these descriptions are true. It's true to say that this thing has a certain mass. It's, of course, true, but the truth maker for these propositions are not properties that sit in these objects. The truth maker comes in through the laws. And when you attribute a mass, a charge, etc., to these objects, you say something about their behavior, how they move, what the patterns are in their motion. This comes from the laws, and this supervenes on the mosaic as a whole. So once you have, so these are variables. So far as properties appear in physics, they appear as variables, as parameters in the dynamical laws. So they have a nomological status. They are there to tell us something about how the matter moves. They get this nomological status from their positions in the laws. The laws as a whole supervene. Supervene on what? Well, supervene on the patterns of change in the distance relation. That's all. So if you apply this to classical mechanics, that's, as I said, that's easy. You need this, you need mass, charge, etc., forces and what have you as predicates. The propositions in which these predicates appear are true, perfectly true, but they don't refer to any properties that are out there in the world. The same when you go, the question is, well, how can you be a Leibnizian about relations and accept Newtonian mechanics? Well, it's the same story. Acceleration as a property of an object, what an inertial system is, etc., the supervenes on the pattern in the history of the spatial relations among the Newtonian particles. So everything else, apart from these supervenient spaces of points connected by distance relations and change in these distance relations, supervenes on the patterns that the change happens to manifest. Now you can do the same with quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, instead of classical forces, you have a wave function which represents the quantum state, figures in the laws, and the same. You can make exactly the same move. The propositions that describe a quantum state are true, but the truth maker is not anything that there is out there in the world over and above the distance relations and their change. The truth maker is the patterns, the change, and it can be the correlated change as in the non-locality PR experiments, and then Einstein objections against the quantum mechanics that you can have correlated motions or correlated behavior of quantum objects independently of their distance as well. These are just, again, these are just patterns of motions in the objects, and by ascribing a wave function to these objects and entanglement, metaphysics of entanglement, whatever you have for a union, this is not a problem. This can just supervene again, the same way as mass and charge in classical mechanics can supervene, so wave functions, entanglement, what have you, can supervene on the change on the distance relations that you have. This is an old idea that you find in Russell in another context where he says in the analysis of matter there are many possible ways of turning some things he had to regard it as real into mere laws concerning the other thing. That's what we just did. Just said mass, charge, quantum states, and what have you, they are not anything that refers to natural properties or the like. They are just laws concerning the other things. Obviously, there must be a limit to this process, or else all the things in the world will merely be each other's washing. The limit, the bedrock, will be reached once we have points, standing and distance relations, because we cannot do away with those relations, then we would lose the world and we wouldn't have the world. So this is the where we reach the limit, distances between points, that avoids circularity, and all the rest are mere laws concerning the behavior, concerning the change of these distance relations. You can throw away these local natural properties. They don't do any work for the supervenience spaces. They only get the union into trouble. So the union is better off throwing them away. And you can run away by throwing them away. The position becomes stronger. Okay? Now see what happens with the friend of powers. The friend of power thinks that the causal role is essential to a property. So where the union takes this to be a contingent matter of fact, that mass results in attraction of objects, etc. The person who thinks of mass as a disposition or power assumes that this causal role is essential, and thereby no criticism, no humility can arise, because the causal role is the essence, so there's no hidden quality, there's nothing that we cannot know, because we see what role the role. But the essence of a property is manifest itself in the way in which it changes the objects, that you have to buy into a primitive modality. In any possible world in which the property is instantiated, it will exercise the same role, and you have a modal, if not a necessary connection between the presence of a disposition or power and its manifestation, so that the job of the properties that the configuration of matter at a certain time instance, yes, is to constrain the evolution. So if you have the distribution of mass in this room, if mass is a power, if the laws supervene on that power, then the fact that there's then the fact how the fact about how the how mass is distributed in this room constrains the evolution of the objects in this room. They will be attracted. So the sun has a big mass, the earth has a comparatively small mass. Why does the earth go around the sun and not simply run away into space? Because the mass of the sun exercises essential for the mass of the sun to exercise the role of attracting bodies that have a lower mass and have not such big a mass. Okay? So you don't get into the trouble of quiddityism and humility, and you have to pay a certain price for it. The price is to endorse primitive modality. There's nothing wrong about doing so. It's just that the issue of modality is not the issue this afternoon. Now, the argument now is that I want to know how this goes. How is a property in the sense of an intrinsic property supposed to exercise a certain causal role? If the sun and the earth, there's quite a big distance between these two objects. So how does the sun, in virtue of having an intrinsic mass, change or influence the motion of the earth? It accelerates that. So can I ask this question? How can a particle, in virtue of possessing a disposition of power that is intrinsic to it, reach out across space to change the state of motion of other particles? I find this puzzling. I mean, this is all the puzzle then you get about actual distance and Newton, etc. And then you have the idea, okay, so it can't be at a distance, so something has to walk from here to there. So that this body influences that body, there's something that has to go from here to there, a force or a field. If it is a field, the action is retarded, so it may take some time. But this does not get you out of the trouble, because now the question is, what is the force or the field? It can't be the manifestation of the disposition, because the manifestation of the disposition of this body is the motion, the change in the motion of that other body. If you have some mediator of the interaction, then either it would be the manifestation of the disposition, which it is not, and it would be another disposition. So you can say forces or fields are again dispositions, and the manifestation is here. But then you have two dispositions for one and the same manifestation, which is a bit too much. It's exactly one too much. You should have one. So you would have the original disposition being the mass intrinsic to this object, manifesting itself in the acceleration of that object via a force or field, which again also is the disposition to change the motion of this object once it has reached this object. So that's too much. You should be able to cut off at least one of them. But if you have if you just have the field as disposition, you don't have the answer to the question, and you don't need the mass, so you're not out of this trouble. Okay? So even in classical mechanics, I'll put it that way, the idea that you have intrinsic properties of objects, the idea that physical variables describe intrinsic properties of objects, then gets you into the trouble that starts with Newton, when Newton says that, how did he say this? This famous letter to Bentley where he speaks against action at a distance, against the action at a distance of his own theory, which he says that the idea that a body can reach out to another body and change the motion of that other body without some medium going from the one to the other body is very strange to him, and he thinks that no man with any capacity of reasoning could ever fall into it. So he's strongly opposed to that. And then the solution is known from Maxwell on from the 19th century, you have the field solution, but that field solution does not help you. Because then the status of the field is unclear. So Hartwig Field, philosopher Field, who likes fields very much, says that the field as a property of space-time bonds. Okay, so then you would again, you would have now dispositional properties of space-time bonds, okay, that manifest themselves somewhere, but that then you have two times dispositions, and one dispositions that are really then the object, and the other some sort of fishy or ghostly disposition which is out there, an empty space, just as a truth maker for counterfactual propositions about what would happen to bodies if they were there. So all this gets you, I want to say, all this gets you into a mess and into trouble. So the whole idea, so there's something wrong in the whole idea. And what is wrong in the idea is, of course, to think of mass, charge, etc., as intrinsic powers or dispositions of objects. Ernst Mach, who did a good service for Leibniz and helping Leibniz out against Newton, where he could not reply, also remarks that when Newton introduces mass, he does not introduce mass as an intrinsic property. What he does, in fact, in his theory, is introducing a coupling parameter, introducing a parameter that couples the motion of that body to the motion of that body, in fact, that couples the motions of all the bodies in the world to each other. And again, the idea that there may be something, a power or a disposition that is modal, that puts constraint on the development of the world, that idea is not wrong-headed. It's just wrong-headed to spell that idea out in terms of intrinsic properties. If you spell it out in terms of relations, you can do so, and you're well advised to do so already for classical mechanics, then everything is fine, because then the question does not arise how a body can change and the motion of another body in virtue of something that is intrinsic to it. There's nothing intrinsic to that body, nothing intrinsic to that body. There's just distance relations between them, and there's a dynamical relation in which these objects stand, but nothing that is intrinsic to them. And of course, when you go to quantum mechanics, you're forced into this view because, again, as I said, the wave function is the central dynamical parameter, and now even mass charge are situated, all the dynamics are situated on the level of the wave function. The wave function tells you where the object is, but the wave function may describe the object as being in superposition. So it's the wave function, it's not something local that is in the quantum particles. Again, it's the wave function where mass and charge are situated, where all the dynamic goes on. You know the story, the wave function is entangled, so you cannot attribute wave functions to particles taken individually in quantum mechanics. You can only attribute a wave function to the whole configuration of matter. So a wave function cannot, it's just out of question to think that a wave function can represent intrinsic properties. You may be a Humean about the wave function, you may be a dispositionalist about the wave function, power person about the wave function, but in any case, there's nothing which comes close to an intrinsic property here. So what you get is a dynamical structure. You can get this dynamical structure view already for classical mechanics. You are pushed into it. If you're a friend of powers, the only chance you have in quantum physics is to go for entanglement, to say that the wave function parameter represents a relation that takes all, in the last resort, all the quantum objects, all the particles as its relata. So we get a powerful structure, so to speak, that constrains the evolution of the configuration of matter, or in the deterministic case, fixes one evolution. And then you get as a benefit out of all this, a metaphysics that's a strong contender for quantum physics. It's a strong contender for a plausible stance in the metaphysics of contemporary physics, whereas the old idea that you have intrinsic properties is just out. There are not much things that are refuted by physics, but the idea that the Aristotelian idea that you have intrinsic properties is refuted by physics, if anything is refuted by physics. So, again, switching from properties to relations helps in this case. It avoids, now you don't have a knockdown objection like criticism or humility here, but you have, I would say, an artificial problem here. The artificial problem of how this object can move that object in virtue of something that is intrinsic, which has nothing that is intrinsic to it, there's just a dynamic relationship, a dynamic structure in which these two objects stand. So you avoid an artificial problem and you make the position stronger when it comes to contemporary physics, because now you turn this position into a stance that is valid, that is valuable, that has a good chance of being true with respect to modern physics. The conclusion is that there is no reason to admit properties in metaphysics, neither on the categorical nor on the dispositionalist view. Relations are sufficient to do all the work. If you're just living on bread and water, if you're a Humean when it comes to metaphysics, then the spatial relations are sufficient. They are the water that keeps the bread together, the meta points, and everything else supervenes on it. Spatial relations aren't modal relations. There's nothing modal in distance relations. You need them anyway, as that what individuates your object. Yes, in brackets, because there are 2 or 3 minutes left. I should say that there is much confusion, to my mind, much confusion going on. Of course, the relations of entanglement cannot individuate any object. And the whole discussion about absolute weak discernibility and all the same things in quantum physics is misplaced, because it's misplaced when applied to quantum entanglement, because the entanglement is not supposed to individuate any objects. Why not? Because the wave function and the formalism of quantum mechanics is applied, is situated in what is called configuration space, the space in which each point of which represents a possible configuration of the whole matter in the world. So, and the wave function acts on these points of configuration space, so it presupposes that there's a configuration of matter out there in the world on which it acts, and that configuration cannot be what there is in that configuration cannot be individuated by what is represented by the wave function. So the job is something else. You need the spatial relations in any case, whether you're a Humean or a power person or whatever, as the relations that fulfill the task of individuating the basic objects. If you think that there is something that constrains the evolution of your configuration of matter, something modal, something which is dynamical and modal, then you need, in addition to the relations that individuate the object, something that fulfills the task of constraining their evolution. And then these are dynamical relations represented by the laws of classical mechanics, by coupling parameters such as mass and charge, quantum mechanics, by the quantum state as expressed in terms of the wave function. So then you need, so if you're a dispositionalist, you need 2 types of relations. You need the relations that individuate your basic objects, and you need the relations that constrain the dynamics. If you're a Humean, you can cut off the second relations, because there's nothing that constrains the evolution of what there is in the world. Some such evolutions just happen to take place, and you look for the best system that sums up how the evolution goes on. And that's how then these dynamical parameters come in. In any case, you do a good service to the Humean, because they no longer have to worry about quiditism and humility, and you do a good service to the power front, because they get now a metaphysics which does not run into artificial problems, and which is in accord with contemporary physics. And that's all you can want to have, really.